Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, August 28th. I'm Ray Graff. It's time to assemble the geniuses, the brainiacs. The Science Forum is on Vox Pop, and we have our panel here ready to answer your scientific questions. The number is 800-3... Well, it's a panel of two, right? You'll get individualized service. The number is 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. You can email voxpop@wamc.org with your science question. A couple people have done that already. voxpop@wamc.org for the email and the number 800-348-2551. Science. It's always all about science. Your calls coming up. Well, howdy. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Science Forum today, one of my favorite days of the month. If you have a question, science-related, give us a call at 800-348-2551. You know, it could be a simple question. We have all kinds of simple questions about ice making and hanging clothes out to dry. Whatever is puzzling you, call, and the scientists will give it a whack. 800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Well, let's see. I'll take attendance here. It's we're short a couple of scientists today. Let's have our... I wonder how long this will take. Let's have our panel of scientists. Sign in, please.
Well, I can talk slower. Hi, it's Barbara Brabets. I'm a biochemist from SUNY Cobleskill.
You look very relaxed. What happened?
Summer, yeah. And then prolonged summer.
Oh,
I don't have any teaching duties this semester. I'm doing research.
Oh, my. And so what is research?
Oh, it's water quality stuff. As they would say, I look for poop in water and find it everywhere.
So, okay. Well, yep. Enjoy. Enjoy your autumn.
That's my relaxing research.
And then who are you?
I'm Ed Stander. I'm teaching all of her courses. Having just an absolutely wonderful time doing it. But I'm really just here for the comic relief.
How long? That's not true. How long have classes been going on over Kobe?
4 days.
4 days?
Yeah. Yeah.
Are you already downtrodden by this, Ed?
It's like three times as long as that.
The 2 weeks before classes are usually pretty hard.
Yeah.
Because you got to get everything ready.
Right.
And, it, you know, you got to get yourself up and dressed and to work and read all those emails that you've been ignoring all summer. Mm-hmm. Yep.
How are the students this year? Bright and bushy-tailed and whatnot?
They're ready to learn because they have lots of room in their brains.
Ooh, well, I hope they're not listening. Well, it's a fair bet that they're not. Okay. Barbara, you said that there's a recruitment drive going on?
Yes. Even though we've just inaugurated our 2029 class, we have the 2030 class has opened up, like the enrollment period for that has started. And so the college has a couple of events coming up. There's on Monday, September 29th, there's a campus-wide college information day, which is for anybody who wants to go anywhere. It's kind of like introduction to what it takes to apply to college. It doesn't have to be SUNY Cobleskill. And then we have an event in October on the 25th, so that's the Saturday before Halloween. And it's usually a beautiful event, and that's an open house. So that's if you're thinking about college and you're thinking SUNY Cobleskill might fit you, but you don't necessarily know if that's the answer, you come on down on that Saturday and you can take tours and meet faculty like us and, you know, pet a goat or two. It's usually pretty fun.
Pet a goat or two.
Yeah.
And then, way to sell it, Barb.
Yeah,
that's where pedagogy comes from.
Very clever.
That is
well
good.
Played.
We do it again November 15th.
You know, I love Cobleskill.
And the Burger King.
Well, I've not actually been in the college, but I've driven through the town
and seen
the school. I tell you.
We'll do a remote someday.
That town, thanks. That's because I'd love to do another on-the-road event as soon as possible.
Thank you
for bringing that up. No, but it's a great town. And there's a teeny little movie theater in that town.
Oh, it's
lovely.
What's
the deal with that?
It's so the movie theater only has it's the same showing times, Tuesday through Sunday.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter what movie it is. And usually it's because I think the family has been in the movie business so long, they have really good priority as far as the blockbuster hits. So
they have new movies. So
oh,
it's not
no,
like
it's
a Fatty Arbuckle.
It's all first run stuff. And, you know, it's $1.50 for popcorn. I mean, you know.
You really can't say prices on public radio, but you don't work there.
I'm so it's fine. So I didn't say whether it was dollars.
Or how big the popcorn is.
True. But the prices are very reasonable. And I don't think there's anywhere locally that has lower prices.
I tell you what, it is it's a lovely town. Now, a couple of my friends went there all those decades ago when I was a youngster. And it was basically ag tech school. Is that the
right? And
the
at
case
the time,
now?
Probably 2 year only. But we've been 2 year, 4 year for almost 40 years. So
it's over 40 years ago. Go figure. Boy, I'm old and ready to retire.
And I want to mention that it's the only SUNY system school on a Drumlin.
Really?
Oh, really? Yes, Cortland's not on a Drumlin.
Cortland is not on a Drumlin. The only SUNY school that's on a Drumlin.
Well, Mr. Geologist, why don't you tell us what a Drumlin is?
It's a hill.
But it's a hill made by
glaciers.
So it's like a glacial hill.
So it's just deposits of stuff?
Well, it's deposits of stuff, but it always has a particular form. It's always steep on one side and goes down shallow on the other side. And
is that why you decided to teach there?
That, you know, when I did my undergraduate degree, we went to SUNY Cobleskill to see the Drumlin.
Yeah, there's a lot of great geology underground, too. The caves of Howe Caverns and Secret Caverns. And there are noses of granite that stick up that the glaciers tried to take down as much as they could, but the granite resisted. And some terrific geology walks. In fact, not too far from here, the Geological Society of America, the New York State...
NYSGA.
What is it? NYSGA is having their conference... in a Drumlin-esque area, but it's not in Cobleskill this year. But they're going to do tours of all of the upstate geological features.
So cool. And isn't Cobleskill also home to several Revolutionary War sites?
Well, Timothy Murphy was a patriot, and he fought during the American Revolution right on the flat plains where now you can buy your carrots and your potatoes and your corn.
Yeah.
So, you know, they call it the breadbasket of the Revolution because... whoever controlled those agricultural fertile lands really would control the food supplies for both the British and the Revolutionary armies. And so the Old Stone Fort, there was a battle there as well. And Tim Murphy was involved somehow. He did survive at some point, but he's gone now.
He's buried in the cemetery with a big plaque for him.
Well, I assume SUNY Cobleskill will be doing stuff in honor of America 250 next year.
I'm sure we will.
But you don't know what it is.
I don't have it on my phone yet.
Will we be petting goats in honor of that?
Well, with a tricorn hat on.
Yeah. All right. I guess we've wasted enough time chit-chatting here. The number here is 800-348-2551. Yeah, buddy. It's the Science Forum. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. A couple emails came in. This one came in about lunchtime. This is from Jay. White light is made of many colors. Each color is a different wavelength. Do all the colors travel at the same speed collectively as white light? Can you explain why things are different colors? Several questions there.
Wow. Pick them all apart. Well, I happen to be wearing a tie-dye shirt today.
Very
so
hip.
I'm like the rainbow in the room. Generally speaking, light in a vacuum, let me say it that way, all travels at the same speed. We call it the speed of light. It's 3 × 10⁸ meters per second. But what varies is how many wiggles per second they have. The frequency or the wavelength are two different things, but they all travel at the same speed-ish. There are differences when we get into media that are not vacuums, but generally that's the case. You want to add to that, Ed?
Well, that'll do it. And the reason why white light breaks up into its components is because it goes through a material which effectively slows down?
Separates. Yeah, I think separates
them. Refracts, depending on the frequency of the light.
Right. So that's like a prism, for example, or a raindrop mm-hmm. in the case of a rainbow. You're going from one medium to another medium, and how that light behaves and that as it moves from one medium to the other changes, and that's what separates the colors.
Right, but the speed stays the same.
On my shirt, what happened is there are dyes there. White light is hitting my shirt, and then certain colors of the spectrum are being absorbed into the shirt, and others are being reflected.
Interesting.
So my red part of the shirt, all the colors but red are being absorbed into the shirt, and then the red light is being bounced back towards you.
You know, on the bird show, we sometimes talk about different color birds, and there are some, Guthrie tells me, that they're not the color that you see.
Correct, like hummingbirds.
Yeah, isn't that wild?
Yeah, and they move their feathers, and the color changes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. There are things,
awesome.
Even in rocks, there are things called Schillerian textures,
hmm.
where you have two effectively two materials which are just slightly different to each other, and as a result, they interact, they interfere with each other, which produce different colors.
Interesting.
Labradorite is a good example of that. And it's the same thing with butterflies.
Oh, cool.
The number here is 800-348-2551. It's voxpop@wamc.org if you want to email. One more email, and then we'll take a break, and then we'll go to the phone. Science Forum today with Barbara Brabets, who will soon be on sabbatical and just having a great old time in the water. And Ed Stander, who's already 4 days in to the new semester over at SUNY Cobleskill. And boy, he looks downtrodden already. It's amazing. It's just incredible. Nick writes in, I dropped the can of seltzer, opened it right away, and no fizz came out. Why? When compared to a bottle, that would volcano no matter what. Maybe it was flat.
I would say it was either flat or it was a very, very, very clean can.
What do you mean?
Well, yeah. Because
the inside of the can has to have imperfections to make the bubbles start.
Huh.
Yeah, and it has to have particles in there as well, because effectively, if a bubble tries to form and the curvature is too little, it'll shrink and disappear. So to get the right curvature on a bubble that forms in a seltzer or anything else, it actually has to hook onto something that's already curved, and that allows it to get a much larger curve so that it forms and it can get bigger.
But isn't the seltzer already carbonated when it goes in the can?
But it's dissolved in, so it because it's pressurized, the bubbles, you don't see the bubbles. The gas is dissolved the way that sugar can dissolve or salt can dissolve in water. It disappears. It's still there, but you don't see the gas until it has a nucleation point to then come out of solution.
And then it exsolves.
Wait, would you like another question about seltzer? Because Nick's got a million.
Sure.
I love seltzer.
Is seltzer as hydrating as regular water?
No, it isn't.
Why?
Because of the acidity that's in it. It's it has a little bit of salt, but not a lot. But mostly it has usually acids in it that make it have that biting flavor so that it doesn't just taste flat. And that acidity cannot be as refreshing on your mouth. Your mouth has a pH that's just slightly over basic. When you neutralize or acidify your mouth feels less refreshed. That's what this craze with the basic water is about.
Yeah.
The basic water doesn't really do anything once it hits your stomach. I mean, it does some chemistry, but it gets neutralized pretty quickly. But as far as your mouth feels, your mouth is more refreshed by the slightly basic water.
Now, yeah. Will beer have a hydrating effect if I have enough?
Except for the pee problem that you have. But here we go right to body fluids, because it interferes with your ability to retain water.
Yeah, and you get the same thing, for example, from lemons. One of the reasons your mouth puckers when you have lemons is because it's actually taking water out of your cells.
Uh-huh. All right. Well, on all of that, let's take a break here. It's the Science Forum, and we are in really rare form today. 800-348-2551. Little James Cotton. Creeper, it's Vox Pop, little James Cotton for you here. Science Forum, 800-348-2551. That's the telephone number. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org, and we will attend to the email bag in a little bit, but let's go to the phones. Emily, the sainted Emily, is in Shelburne Falls, Massachusetts. You're on. Go ahead.
Oh, Ray, you make me laugh so much. And again, I'm sorry I missed you yesterday, even though I know.
No, it was fun. It was really fun. Oh, we had a good time.
Oh,
yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
Good. So I have, because it's summer, I've been indulging myself with root beer floats. And a brown cow is a, know what it is?
It's ice cream with root beers, right?
It's coffee ice cream with root beer.
Ah.
Do you know what a black cow is?
Steely Dan song, one of my favorites.
I don't know. That wasn't on my science repertoire.
Is with Coca-Cola.
Oh, I see.
I love those Coke floats. All right, anyway, go ahead.
So while experiencing the delight of my root beer float, my coffee ice cream really iced up. And I had that in my area, which is Massachusetts. I was in Northfield. And then I went to Maine, and I was in Bath, and we went to a soda fountain right up, in Bath. And the same thing happened to my coffee ice cream, but my friend had strawberry ice cream in her root beer float, and it didn't ice up. So the owner gave me a cup of coffee ice cream to see if it was icing up without root beer in it. Is there any explanation for coffee ice cream icing up more than another ice cream, or because it didn't ice up in the cup?
Right off the bat, I would say that the coffee ice cream was at a much lower temperature than the other ice cream, and it was probably in the freezer a lot longer.
And he said they were new tubs.
That doesn't matter because it's got to come from somewhere else.
Right, because it's frozen. You know, they transport it frozen.
Make it there.
Well, that's true, too.
They didn't, I'm sure. Yeah. It was Giffords.
And it's not bad. I've had it up there myself. It's all right. Could it be the overrun? Maybe there was more overrun in the strawberry, and it was less air.
There could have been less air or more air.
I think we had a question probably about 10 years ago about strawberry ice cream melting faster, and I think we did some homework and found that it just wasn't because you've got the chunks of the strawberry in it, that it doesn't have as much sugar in it as the others.
The reason I bring it up about the ice cream and possibly being a different overrun, back in the day, my mother, in a desperate attempt to get me to lose weight, would sometimes give us ice milk, which was a thing in the 70s, and it was terrible stuff. And so if you put that in a soda, it would do those crystals so fast. So I wonder if it's either water content or something else in that coffee ice cream that is different.
Thank you for that, Ray, because here in Western Mass, that we have Snow's ice cream and Bart's ice cream, and they're both were manufactured in Greenfield. Actually, friends of mine owned this company for 40 years, and one of them is made with milk, so Snow's, and one is made with cream, Bart's. Mm. So now that you said that, I'm going to try that, and I will get back to you.
Yeah, you have homework.
Like a delicious homework.
You know, and remember, Emily, I know nothing about anything, so it's quite possible I'm way off.
But there's another thing there,
too. No, that's curious, though. That you say that, I'm going to try that.
All right, Ed, go ahead very quickly while Emily's still here.
Yeah, there's another part to it, too, is that when you put the ice cream in the soda, it starts to fuzz up really, really quickly. Because the ice cream acts as the nucleation sites, like we talked in the last talk. So you want it to actually ice up a little bit on the outside, or it's going to wind up disappearing almost completely and foaming over the top.
Wow. Well, that could be.
And coffee ice cream is pretty homogeneous. It's got the coffee kind of like mixed in, right? But strawberry is like notorious, like chocolate chip, and it's got chunks in it. And it's kind of, it's got just that different consistency. And I believe that's probably where the crux of it lies.
All right, Emily, thanks a lot for the call and getting us started here. The number is 800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum with Barbara Bravitz and Ed Stander. And let's go to Matamoros, Pennsylvania. Mary, you know, Mary, there's really only one caller that I've ever had from Matamoros, Pennsylvania.
I know, Mr. Jim, and I hope he has some words of wisdom or a trick question for you today.
Do you know him? Do you know Jim?
No, I would wonder. I always wonder who he is.
Yeah.
And it's just delightful.
Oh, good. Well, you may hear him before too long. So go ahead.
Okay, so here we are. My radio, I really like my radio, and it'll be turn it on, and not always, but sometimes, I don't know, depending on whatever's going on outside, it'll be staticky or fuzzy, and the reception kind of comes in and comes out. And then if I walk by the radio near the antenna, or if I put it on the floor when I'm sitting and knitting and listening to the radio, it clears up. What's going on?
You're an antenna, Mary. All right, go ahead.
Yes, you're an antenna, Mary. Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
No, you go ahead. No.
Well, there's induction involved, too, right? Go ahead, Ed. You're the scientist. Go ahead, man.
Yeah, okay. Well, basically, the closer you get to the antenna, you start becoming effectively a part of the loop, and the static effectively, if you can, it comes out of the antenna, goes into your body, into the ground. So you're increasing the ground of that antenna. You can actually get a better signal as a result as well, which is one of the main reasons why the static disappears.
I assume this is AM radio you're talking about, Mary.
No, the FM. Your FM station.
Yeah, it'll do the same thing.
Okay.
Even for digital FM? I thought digital FM was a different beast.
No, radio. Most radios aren't digital FM. No, okay. It's only television. No,
that particular experiment didn't go over that well.
That's fine by me because I don't get any out where I live. So
anyway, Mary, does that clear it up for you?
Well, that's just very interesting. I'm part of the grounding system, then. What's happening.
That's right. Whoa. And the reason sometimes there's more static than other times is simply the way the signal is being propagated through the air.
Right. Sometimes water vapor can dissipate the signal, too. So on particularly humid or wet days, it decreases the signal.
Yeah. We're in a valley between two parts of the range down here on the Delaware. So you've got the river right here with the fog rising in the morning. And then,
interesting.
So, I can see that. Yeah. Okay, well, thank you so much. That was fun.
Don't be a stranger. Thanks, Mary. Appreciate the call. 800-348-2551. Those people in Matamoros are so nice.
Aren't they?
Let's talk to another one. Jim in Matamoros, you're on.
Wow, Jim.
When a camera gets dunked in water, what's the most likely internal part to get fried?
A camera?
What kind of camera?
Are we talking film or digital?
Well, Nikon LD, was it L30?
It's a digital camera.
It's a digital camera?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, well, anything that gets wet inside there is going to wind up frying it because they're not designed to be waterproof in any way, shape, or form.
Interestingly, though, I worked with a guy, Time Warner, which is long gone, years ago, and he said one day they were on a shoot on the Hudson River in a boat, and they had a very expensive Ikigami video camera, and somebody, presumably got fired right afterwards, dropped it in the Hudson.
Right.
And it was tethered to a wire. It wasn't a wireless. And they pulled it up, and they bathed it in distilled water and just dried it for weeks, and that thing worked for a long time.
And that's what you do if you drop a camera in the water, is you bathe it in distilled water for a good period of time.
Right, because you're going to short it out with the ions that are in the water that got in it.
Yeah.
Right?
And then dry it out very slowly.
And it might work, Jim. Is that all right?
I hope so. no luck so far in a couple of weeks.
Oh, man, I'm sorry. Well, give it a shot. If not, hey, you know what? Maybe Mary over there in Matamoros has one you can borrow. But thank you very much for the call. Let's go to Troy, New York. It's Michael. Michael, you're on.
Hi, this is Michael. Yeah, I'm a gourmet chef.
Oh, congratulations.
You've been talking about root beer floats.
Yeah.
And a number of people feel that all of their taste buds are on their tongue. And actually, 20% of your taste buds are on the roof of your mouth. So when you're having that root beer float or a chocolate milk or whatever, an orange juice, if you swirl it around in your mouth, you get more flavor out of the experience.
I'll do that.
There's also a phenomenon where when you swirl it in your mouth, you create these whirls of air mixed with the liquid, and then that captures some of those flavor molecules and travels up into your sinuses and into your nose. And without smell, taste is really very bland. So I know people who've lost the sense of smell, and they've told me that they rather that they were blind or deaf than lost the sense of smell because they've lost taste.
Yeah.
And they really miss that kind of wonderful symphony of subtleties that they can get from food and food and drink.
That's what I say when I go to Arby's.
Yeah.
By the way.
Another interesting tidbit. Am I okay to talk?
Yeah, go ahead, Michael. Go.
Anyway, I'm a gourmet chef, and there's a thing called boileau.
Mm-hmm.
When you introduce some food or drink in your mouth, you get taste, texture, and boileau. Boileau is how it reacts to your tongue. Huh. For instance, if you drink 1% milk, and then you have some heavy cream, your tongue can distinguish the essence
difference.
Of the liquid.
Yeah.
So it's taste, texture, voilure.
Can you spell that, Michael?
I really can. It's a French word. I think it's pretty much just phonetic. Bois, B, I really can't know. I'm familiar with the term, but...
In English, it's voilure. Just velure.
Hey, Michael, thank you for that one. 800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum. Barbara Brabets is here. Ed Stander is here. And we are off to a flying start. Here.
Aren't we?
Yeah, I'm flying already. Can you believe it? It's amazing how much fun you can have, right? Let's go to Yorktown. Cheryl, you're in Yorktown. I love Yorktown. Welcome.
You do, huh?
Yeah,
okay.
I love it down there.
I'm having a wonderful time. This is so nerdy.
Well, that's my specialty. Go ahead.
Yes. Well, when you were talking about the geological formations, okay, I was interested if you could talk a little bit about the formations you can actually see. I think you can still see along old Route 20. Well, it's not Route 20, which had mammoth rock cuts. So it would be like on the northern end of Schoharie County and crossing over into, I guess it would be Otsego would be the next one to the west and going on further west, which I think was all underwater at one time.
You are right, Ed's wheelhouse.
I just mapped those. When you're at Sharon Springs, you're into the limestones. It's a group called the Helderberg Group. And it was all deposited about 350 million years ago in a shallow sea behind the Taconic Mountains.
What critters are in that limestone?
Oh, pretty well everything. It's a pretty nasty limestone as far as critters.
So it's like brachiopods and shells.
Cool.
Yeah.
I was a little kid when we moved to a farm in Sharon up on the hill halfway to Cherry Valley. Mm-hmm. And I was fascinated with the rocks. I would just clamber. You could still see them. They weren't covered up with dirt, and they were filled with fossils.
Yep.
But I didn't know what they all were.
Well, if you keep going from Sharon west, then you get into what's called the Cherry Valley Limestone, which is also very fossiliferous. But you can't miss it because it has these huge flint nodules sticking in it all over the place.
And if you are on Route 20 heading west at Cherry Valley, there's like a high point. There's a pull-off on both sides of the road. On the north side of the road, it's like a parking area. You pull off, and the DOT has actually taken some rock from elsewhere in the county and put them right there as kind of like bumps for where the car doesn't, so the car doesn't drive on the grass. And they're loaded with beautiful fossils. So you don't even have to do much but get out of your car and look at them. I don't know where those rocks come from because, of course, they were placed there by DOT, but they are lovely, and they are local.
And they didn't think anybody would want to know.
Well, I don't know, but I'm glad that they didn't just, like, pick a piece of old concrete and stick it there. You know, you get an extra benefit.
It's much better. Yeah.
Hey, Cheryl, I have a question for you. Are you listening on our Mount Kisco transmitter, or are you listening online?
No, I'm listening online. I can't pick up the Mount Kisco transmitter, which goes back to that lady who was talking about FM antennas.
Yeah.
I have no idea how to pick up half of the FM stations, which are nearby.
Yeah, I mean, outside antennas are still best, and directional ones are better than that. But, you know, sometimes you're out of luck depending on where you are.
It's a bit of trial and error, I
think. I can't get it at all.
Thankfully, there's an internet now, you know?
Yes, right.
Well, Cheryl, thanks a lot for the call. By the way, Brian writes in here about Jim from Matamoros' issue with the watery camera. It makes a great point, and I thought it went without saying, but I'm glad you brought it up, Brian. If the camera was powered on when it was submerged, it's likely toast. I mean, there's probably no salvaging the thing. So thank you for that. Number here is 800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. Let's grab one more call before the next break. Sam in Saratoga. Sam, you're on.
Hey, how's it going? So I'm doing some research on isoprene, specifically the plant's mechanism to release isoprene and the effects of isoprene in the atmosphere and soil.
Okay.
Specifically, soybean, American chestnut, and potentially willow. And I just wanted to get to see if you guys knew anything, maybe I don't know, or about isoprene or potentially some ideas of some new projects I could do about it.
Well, so let me kind of get the callers, you know, you can stop me and interject as you need to, because it sounds like you know a lot about isoprene. But isoprene is a form of molecule that's very common in plants, especially fruits and vegetables. And it is one of those molecules that we think is a good thing to have in your fruit or vegetable. It's kind of a basic building block, and it looks like a Y, if you think about shapes of molecules. And it's got double and single bonds in it. And they tend to alternate, one double, then a single, then a double, then a single. And that seems to be a really healthy thing to have. I don't know about the volatility of isoprene. All of the isoprene molecules I've ever worked with have been, we've extracted them as liquids, but I assume there is a volatility to them. Like if you have a hot area and you've got these plants growing, these plants obviously degas somewhat, right? They give off oxygen. And you're saying that you're detecting isoprene in the atmosphere that are coming from these plants. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
And you're doing it to what end? Are you trying to look at productivity of the plants or the healthiness of the atmosphere?
Well, at the moment, I'm trying to figure out the productivity or like how isoprene can help deter potential mortality from insects or diseases, and also add fertility to soil in general.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's a good molecule for us, so I hate to be so human-centric, but we assume that it's also good for the environment, and I think that's kind of what you're getting at. A lot of time, there's a lot of the other indicators out there of productivity are things like primary photosynthetic productivity. You can put up a monitor in the sky. You can do this on a satellite. You can do this on a drone. And you can look at the reflection of light off of the plant leaves. And from that, you can kind of get an indication as to how well photosynthesis is going on. Uh-huh. And therefore compute that to growth. The problem with isoprene is it's a very bioactive molecule. Right. So if it's released, say it's released into soil, my guess is that it's going to be changed pretty quickly. I don't know what the half-life in active soil would be. Like, is it on the order of days or is it on the order of hours? That's a question I don't know. But it sounds like it would be interesting to watch the decay of isoprene over time or find out what other prenes it turns into, what other terpenes it turns into as it gets converted from one to the other.
Sam, we're overdue for a break, but thanks for the call. It's the Science Forum today with Barbara Brabets and Ed Standard. It's 800-348-2551. VoxPop@WAMC.org for the email. We'll check the email bag in a moment. From Basie's Beetle Bag, babe, there's Count Basie, Hard Day's Night, 800-348-2551, the Science Forum. Rick Orlando, chef and noted smart guy, checked in on the ice cream issue that we discussed. He says, hi, Ray and panel. Just sending a little note on the strawberry or other fruit-based ice cream's melting behavior. The majority of commercial strawberry ice cream contains citric acid. Citric acid lowers the freezing point, which in turn means the ice cream is softer at a given temperature. Mm-hmm. This softness can give the impression that it's melting faster, but the relationship is a bit more complex. Citric acid changes the freezing point depression to citric acid, which means it lowers the freezing point of the water in the ice cream mix. This means that a portion of the ice cream remains in a liquid, unfrozen state at temperatures where pure water would be solid ice. Mm-hmm. This liquid phase contributes to a softer, more scoopable texture, and it's also the part that melts first. So there, says
That's
Rick.
That's great, Rick. Thank you. He's a friend of Sidney Kobleskill. He's been by a number of times.
He's going to be on the show, I think, I don't remember what day, someday in September, I think.
Like a Food Friday?
Yeah, he's on a lot. He's yeah.
I would add to Rick that sugar does exactly the same thing.
Yes.
And the more sugar you put in it, the sweeter it is, the lower the melting point depression is.
Ah, this email from Orlando, but not the same Orlando. Huh. I do not hear any more about the ozone depletion and the hole in the ozone layer. Why not?
Well, for the most part, It is a problem that is fixing itself, I would say. About 30-odd years ago, maybe I'm feeling older.
I think it was more than that, the fluorocarbons?
Yeah. The CFC, like the hairspray change in the late 70s, early 80s, really, those molecules that were released then have a lifetime of about 40 years. So they're just breaking down the ozone now from when they were released 40 years ago.
Yeah.
And then, so from in the first world, we've really stopped using those materials for the most part. There are some that are still ozone depleting. But we've seen a kind of a turnaround of the ozone hole. It's still a seasonal problem.
Yeah.
It opens up in winter, but, you know, you're not sunbathing in Antarctica in the wintertime.
Did it always open in the winter? Were there always spots where it would
open? Yeah, it was always seasonal. So wintertime for us was always the big time.
Yeah.
Australia had the biggest problem because it's our winter is their summer.
Yeah, and what's happening right now actually may wind up depleting the ozone layer even more. It turns out that the satellites that are being used for Starlink, for example, when they come to the end of their age, they shoot down into the atmosphere. And when they do, they melt. And it's producing an incredible amount of aluminum oxide in the environment. The aluminum oxide is also causing a depletion of the ozone layer.
Oh, so that could be our next ozone hole.
That's probably the next one.
Well, maybe they'll have to change what they make them out of, yeah?
Well, they're going to have to do something.
Plywood or something. I think somebody did put up a plywood satellite.
Oh, my gosh, really?
Yeah, that was a test. I think they put one up. It worked.
That's
great. Let's see. Oh, okay. This is from Gregory. Subject heading cold in West Virginia. I just heard Paul Cayano say that the nation's coldest spot in the U.S. yesterday was West Virginia. I know it's a mountainous state, but wouldn't there be mountains a bit further north that would be colder?
It's probably in a valley that the cold temperature was because you get that radiation cooling at night when we have very, very low moisture. I think the dew points last night were in the 30s, which I was just astonished how low the dew points were. And when those dew points are that low, there's so little water to blanket. Everything just kind of thermally regulates, and you end up with really cold valleys because you've got, you know, cold air sinks, right? It's more dense, so it's going to come down to the valleys.
And it's going to get stuck there.
Yeah, so top of a mountain isn't necessarily the coldest spot. It's usually the bottom of the mountain.
Peter in Barryville has another seltzer question for us. Mm. Your guest mentioned that seltzer contains a very small amount of salt. I was under the impression that the difference between seltzer and club soda is that the latter contains salt, the former does not. I just looked down my seltzer bottle. There's not salt mentioned as an ingredient.
Okay, so I'm going to be a chemist. And a salt is anything that is charged, right? So there's bicarbonate and carbonate ions. Don't blow it now, Barb. that are in seltzer that come with the carbonation. And that salt is not sodium chloride, not the stuff that you or I would think of as salt. It wouldn't necessarily taste like that to you or I, but they are salts in the sense that it can deplete anything salty, even if it's not sodium chloride, can really deplete water from your mouth.
All right. And then Peter goes on, forget root beer floats. I'm from the Bronx where the egg cream is king.
Oh, I couldn't do egg cream.
Oh, my God.
No, there's no
egg in there.
No, I understand. It's a texture thing for me.
Oh, my God. It's one of the greatest things ever. I could live on them.
See, it's like you could give me like a little lozenge that tasted like egg cream and I could just suck on a hard candy that was like egg cream. I'd be fine. But back to, you know, the whole idea of those mouth sensations. Textures do me in, man.
Yeah, this comes from a woman who can't eat mushrooms.
That's true.
Really?
They're like
not even on pizza pie.
They're like earthy erasers. They're disgusting.
What about a thin slice on a pizza?
No.
Are you sure?
I've eaten many.
Should I buy some for you?
My husband will gladly eat them.
Really?
Yeah. It's the one thing he had to give up at our wedding vows that he was not really happy about.
Really?
Yeah.
Really? The mushrooms were in the wedding vows?
No, but they should have been because between that and the Tide detergent that I can't stand, he's lacking. These are the things he gave up to be married to me.
You know what? The things I've learned on this show. Patrick writes in with another antenna question. Back in the 80s, we had a rooftop antenna for our TV in Sheffield, Mass. My father always insisted that we turn the TV off when there was thunder and lightning. The only time the TV ever got fried by lightning was about 2 a.m. when it was turned off. Was he scamming us out of our favorite shows? And that's from Patrick in North Adams.
Very nice. It would be the same whether it was turned on or turned off.
Right.
It makes no difference whatsoever.
unless you unplugged your TV every time, and nobody would do that these days. So.
My computer at home is so old that I'm trying to coax life out of it. Every time that there was an electrical storm, I shut it down and unplug it. And I, you know, unfortunately, it's still alive.
Yeah, but, I mean, your wife is probably plugging it in when you're not looking.
All right, last email, and then we'll go back to the phones. This is from John. I make maple syrup in Northwest Connecticut, and on a good day, I'll find sheets of ice in the buckets of sap that I collect. Less in recent years. I've heard that I can remove the ice and pitch it without losing any sugar. But I always feel like I'm losing some sugar as well. Does the ice that forms contain any sugar at all? Sometimes it forms in sheets, and in times it forms heavier, crusty blocks that surely have some sugar in them. What's the science here? How can I reduce my boiling time while not losing sugar content?
Well, ice does not like sugar. In fact, if you grow ice from the top down, it'll dissolve any sugar that could possibly get into it, unless the sugar content gets high enough that it starts forming dendrites at the bottom of the ice sheet.
Those would look like little fingers that little go fingers. Downwards.
And if it does that, then the sugar can get trapped between the dendrites. But ice in a sugar water will take up the water separately. It will not allow the sugar into its structure.
Mm.
In fact, there's almost nothing you can put into ice that will stay there except for maybe fluorine crystals or fluorine atoms. Oh, don't make a mistake now, Ed. Yeah, right. Fluorine, you can actually dope ice with fluorine, but there's almost nothing else you can dope it with.
I think surfactant, too, somehow will go into the ice crystals with the water.
It'll always form dendrites.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Number here is 800-348-2551, Science Forum with Ed Stander and Barbara Brabets. Let's go to Saratoga. Laura, you're on. Hello, Laura.
Hello, how are you?
Good.
I'm calling. I had a bad case of COVID in 2021, and I lost my my sense of smell and taste, and it has not come back. But every once in a while, I'll eat something, lemon or Parmesan cheese or sometimes red wine, and I get this very kind of chemically taste in my mouth. So I was wondering, are my taste buds trying to regenerate, or what would cause suddenly kind of an odd chemical taste in my mouth after all this time?
So your taste buds, if anybody's bitten their tongue, and everybody's bitten their tongue, your taste buds really only last about a week or so before they're regenerated. The damage that likely happened to you was to the nerves that run from your tongue to your brain or from your nose to your brain. That's why some people with long COVID also have like flashes of light behind their eyes. It's because the nerves, the large trunks of nerves that run from the organ to the brain have been damaged by inflammation. Those nerves, they're like a pipe, right? So they have an internal part that conducts, in this case, electricity, and then they have kind of like an insulating outside piece. And what happens in long COVID, and this is all still, you know, up in research, is that there's some nicks in how the types of cells that are there. So instead of looking, if you think of your optic nerve as kind of like a flexible pool noodle with another pool noodle on the outside, that there are defects in it or different types of cells there than were there originally. And so it's not conducting the same message with the same clarity that it used to. When you have an overpowering thing like spicy food, like capsaicin or like lemon, some of these really strong ones, right? Those get through because it's such a strong message that it sends it via kind of like a different pathway. It's still through the same nerve, but it has a different response than the subtle responses that we expect from our taste buds or from our sense of smell. So, and of course, they don't quite come out the way they did before because the pipe is damaged, right? So you're going to leak a little.
Yeah.
So it's not like you're leaking fluid, but you're leaking signal, right? Your signals are going to be staticky. Yeah. And that's what the effect of long COVID is.
So, I mean, how long... We did a show on Monday, Medical Monday, this came up. And basically, and I may be paraphrasing the doctor completely incorrectly because I can barely remember Monday, but I believe that, you know, most of the times you lose your taste buds, the sense of taste, it comes back within a week or two. And I think the inference was if it goes long, it'll probably never come back.
Yeah, probably never come back right. Yeah. It'll always be a little staticky.
That's what I was told.
Yeah. And it's because, you know, those cells rebuild, right? And once you've, if your body has repaired, and put repaired in air quotes because obviously it's not fully repaired on you, if it's repaired it with the wrong type of tissue or the wrong type of protein, anytime that particular area gets replaced in the future, it's going to rewrite with the same type of protein that was there originally. So if you have like a defect in the side of this optic nerve or in the side of your olfactory nerves, and it's the wrong type of covering, then it's going to be the wrong type of covering forever. Just think of it like scar tissue, right? You have a cut on your hand, you get the scar tissue that forms that, you know, your skin has sloughed off zillions of times, but that scar is still there. Just think of that on the side of your nerve, and it's still going to propagate.
Well, Laura, thanks for the call. Let's go to Middleburg. Jerry, you're on.
I'm calling because everybody seemed, or quite a few people were talking about getting a signal from a radio. They're having trouble.
Okay.
I've had many, many radios and broken the antenna off by mistake. Yep. And if you just take a piece of wire, usually copper works best, and tie it to where the antenna stub is there, or in the back of a regular home radio, you'll usually have a screw for an antenna, for a wire antenna to be hooked to it.
True.
And if you just run about a 6-foot wire up and just bread tie it up somewhere until you find the best place for a signal, it works beautiful. It doesn't look the greatest, but I've got an antenna in my house right now that's probably 10 feet long with copper wire. Then it goes to a pair of rabbit ears that I had left over from an old TV. And I can get a signal in bad weather, good weather, whatever's going on.
Beautiful. So, well, that's
great.
Know,
it doesn't look great, but it works good. And if you just move it around, and sometimes if you have to, like I'll lay it right down by the bed. And when I lay down at night, I keep my arm anywhere near that antenna wire, and like, you know, your body does help serve to pick up signals or help it pick up signals.
Back in the old days when we all had stereos, you know, we had receivers and everybody had a receiver. Oftentimes we would make little dipoles with just extra speaker wire, and you could lay them out a couple feet, few feet on each side, and you'd be amazed on FM. Jerry, thanks a lot. Jim in LaGrangeville. Hello, Jim.
Hey, good afternoon, guys. One of the previous callers was talking about isoprene and its reactivity and potentially insect attack for the stuff in the forest. One thing to I used to work for a large pulp and paper manufacturer. Isoprene is one of the basic building blocks of the terpenes, the mono, di, tri, sesqua terpenes, and pine trees will synthesize those building blocks to make mono, di, tri, et cetera. And those compounds, those five-membered rings, I believe, or five-membered unions, contain pheromones that primarily pine trees use to communicate with each other. Increase the amount of sap produced and trap insects from insect attack in the sap from a pine tree, from an attack, and thereby communicating that to the other trees in the forest.
Yeah, and again, just to be very human-centric, you know, pinene, which is one of these terpene molecules, and it's the stuff that is in balsam that makes it a popular candle, you know, a scent or flavor, right? So those very piney smells are exactly those molecules that you're talking about.
Jim, thanks a lot for the call. All right, we have about a minute here. Christopher writes in, many years ago, I was on a geology outing with the late state geologist and Professor Anson Piper. He showed me that the limestone outcroppings south of the village of Whitehall are a 300-million-year-old beach. We found a crinoid in the rock. It took him 45 minutes to chip it out. I was impressed. And that's from Chris.
I would have been impressed, too. I would never spend 45 minutes to take out a crinoid.
Is a crinoid? Crinoid? How do you say that?
Crinoid.
Yeah, what is it?
It's a sea lily.
Really?
Yeah, and they're made up of little plates. And when they die, the plates fall down, so you got plates all over the place. And every once in a while, you can get the bud of the top.
So that was a 300 million year old beach. That's wild.
Well, probably not a beach. Probably a
landslide, maybe.
No. A coral reef or something of that nature.
So interesting. All right. So once again, Barbara Brabets. How do people find out more if they are interested in joining I can't believe it. The class of 2030.
2030.
Yikes. Wow.
Aye, aye, aye. Yeah. www.cobleskill.edu and click the admissions button.
Okay.
And, or contact us.
Yeah.
Yeah, call Ed directly.
Yeah, I'm always there by the side of my phone.
He's the guy with the phone off the hook. 800-348-2551. Write that number down because tomorrow the great Amy Halloran returns. We're out of time. Thanks to Ed Stander, Barbara Bravitz for being here. Thank you for listening. Support comes from the Center at Eagle Hill, Hardwick, Mass., announcing their 2025-26 performance season with subscriptions, tickets, and full schedule available at thecenteroftheeaglehill.org. And Berkshire Taconic Community Foundations, awarding 4,000 grants and scholarships each year through more than 600 funds. Local giving can make an impact. More at berkshiretaconic.org. Once again, thanks to Barb and Ed for being here today. Thank you for listening. Zachary T. Malloy, Tiberius, right? T is for Tiberius. Thank you, Zach. He's our engineer. Susie Check, I screened the calls. I'm Ray Graff. As I said, tomorrow is a beautiful day. It's Flower Hour with Amy Halloran. We will see you at 2:00.